Well, it's good to be back with you Sunday night. Such a wonderful time to gather. I love Sunday night service. I did not grow up with a regular church attendance, and certainly Sunday services were already becoming a way of the dodo bird. But once I got into seminary and got into some Bible teaching churches, and I got to go to some Sunday night services regularly in seminary, man, what a blessing that was. And I've enjoyed that ever since. I'm glad that we now have this. And it's been wonderful working through Job on Sunday evenings, looking at this wonderful book of wisdom. We started back in January of 2025. And so here we are, the summer of 26, almost near the end of Job. Tonight we're in Job 38. We continue with Yahweh's speeches in Job. And remember, Job is a book of wisdom. Just like Pastor Frank reminded us this morning, we need to learn wisdom. We need to learn godly wisdom and not just have the knowledge of what the Bible says, but put it into practice. And that's what this book is about. It's about wisdom, especially regarding the suffering that comes upon us in our lives. What kind of wisdom? How should we live? How should we live a godly life when suffering comes upon us, when suffering happens to us? As one of God's people, how do you think about and put into practice a godly life when you're suffering? That's what the book of Job has been about. We've been through his suffering. We've been through his friends attempting to answer the question of why he's suffering. Job wanting to know the answer to the question of why he's suffering. And then here comes God giving us a great lesson in wisdom. And he doesn't give Job the answer. He skips over Job's question and gives us so much wisdom. So now we're looking at part two, the sovereignty of God and our suffering. Let me read to you all of chapter 38, or at least to verse 38, because that is where we left off last week. We did 1 through 12 last week. This week we'll look at the rest of this section, which goes all the way through verse 38 in Job chapter 38. Then Yahweh answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now gird up your loins like a man, and I will ask you, and you make me know. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me, if understanding, who set its measurements since, or who stretched the line on it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Or who enclosed the sea with doors? When bursting forth, it went out from the womb. When I made a cloud its garment and a dense gloom its swaddling band. And I placed boundaries on it and set a bolt and doors. And I said, thus far you shall come, but no farther, and here shall your proud waves stop. Have you ever in your life commanded the morning and caused the dawn to know its place, that it might seize the ends of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it? It is changed like clay under the seal, and they stand forth like clothing. From the wicked their light is withheld, and the arm raised high is broken. Have you entered into the springs of the sea or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been revealed to you? Or have you seen the gates of the shadow of death? Have you carefully considered the expanse of the earth? Tell me if you know all this. Where is the way to where the light dwells, and darkness, where is its place, that you may take it to its territory and that you may discern the paths to its home? For you were born then, and the number of your days is great. Have you entered the storehouses of the snow, or have you seen the storehouses of the hail, which I have reserved for the time of distress, for the day of war and battle? Where is the way that the light is divided, or the east wind scattered on the earth? Who has cleft a conduit for the flood, or a way for the thunderbolt, to bring rain on a land without people, on a desert without a man in it, to satisfy the waste and desolate land, and to make the growth of grass to sprout? Has the rain a father, Oh, who has begotten the drops of dew? From whose womb has come the ice and the frost of heaven? Who has given it birth? Water becomes hard like stone, and the surface of the deep is interlocked. Can you bind the chains of the Pleiades or loose the cords of Orion? Can you lead forth a constellation in its season and guide the Bear with her satellites? Do you know the statutes of the heavens or fix their rule over the earth? Can you raise your voice up to the clouds so that an abundance of water will cover you? Can you send forth lightnings that they may go and say to you, here we are? Who has given wisdom in the innermost being or given understanding to the mind? Who can count the clouds by wisdom or tip the water jars of the heavens when the dust hardens into a mass and the clods stick together? This is God's answer to Job's question of why is he suffering? Since he's led a righteous life, and God's already told us that in the book. Since Job is one who follows the Lord and turns away from evil, he fears Yahweh. Why? God gives him God's answer here. Often when we ask God for something in prayer, we get an answer, but it's not the one that we asked for or the one we were expecting. And that's what happens here with Job. We looked last week at how this is a challenge to Job. It's a way of what's called a Socratic questioning, where God asks Job questions that Job can't answer, and it's meant to make Job think. It's meant to lead Job to the right understanding of God's sovereignty over our suffering, in our suffering. God's sovereignty and our suffering, how does it fit together? We see the answer here. God is sovereign. He knows what he's doing, and we should trust him. Now, the way that God goes about this is very interesting. We can learn much from this passage. We began this chapter last week, and we looked at all these various things happening in God's creation and in God's maintaining and sustaining of all things in the world. And here we have, once again, this question of weather. The weather comes up over and over in the book of Job: lightning, thunder, storms, ice, snow. And it's often the friends who are bringing this out as well. Job sometimes mentions it. Even today, what's the major complaint that even Christians often have? The weather. It's too hot. It's too cold. The AC's not low enough in here. The AC's too low in here. It's hot outside. It's hot in my car. We love to talk about the weather, often complaining about it. We often think we know so much about the creation, weather patterns, the things that God has made. We know very little. We know more than Job did in his day, but we know very little. If you look up the forecast for the weather and you look up the 10-day forecast, it's only right 50% of the time. Now, we think whatever it says is going to happen in 10 days, it's going to. But it's only right 50% of the time. And even then, it can surprise us. The day before, we think the forecast is set. That's only 90% coming to pass, according to studies. But it can surprise us overnight. Storms can come upon us. And we're going to see God bring these illustrations out, these examples out in his speech. We know and understand so little even today, though. Here's some questions that science has not answered for us. If you were to think of science as a group of people out there studying God's creation, think about this. Why is the sun's outer atmosphere millions of degrees hotter than the surface? Typically, we think of the surface and the core being the hottest. But the atmosphere of the sun, millions of degrees hotter than the surface. Why does the number of sunspots rise and fall every 11 years on a specific cycle? Oh, we know so much, but yet we know so little. And time would fail us to speak of how little we know about outer space. Modern telescopes, we put these awesome telescopes in space to see God's creation, but we know so little. It's thought that there's 2 trillion galaxies, and we can only see a few of them. And they're guessing at the 2 trillion mark based on these little bitty blurry lights in the distance on the Hubble telescope pictures. Astronomers have to guess at that. Only about 5% of the ocean waters have been explored. 5% of the ocean waters. Yes, they've done sonar mapping, even of the Mariana Trench, but only a very small section of that has even been seen by people. A few people have gone down and come back up. It's 7 miles deep. And of all the ocean floor upon the whole earth, only 0.001% of the seafloor has been visually explored or physically analyzed. And these are some of the things we're going to talk about and look at here in this chapter. We don't know all things. We'll never know all things. We can study, we can learn, but we are not God. We do not know all things, much less control all things. God is now challenging Job to consider that. He's going to take Job to school here. He's taking us back to school as well. We've got to go back to science class, and we need to think about knowledge. The word science is really ultimately comes from the Latin word for knowledge. We need to know our God and how he has made all things and controls all things. I told you chapters 38 and 39 have to do with this knowledge. Part one is the physical science, the way that the world is made and works, the way that the universe works, the planets, the weather. That's chapter 38 all the way up through verse 38. Then it switches topics. If you look at verse 39, it's not so much the physical science, but now we're looking at life science. Can you hunt the prey for the lion or fulfill the appetite of young lions? And he goes on to talk about different animals all through the end of chapter 39. So we'll begin to look at those next week. So the first thing God's talking about is his physical world and creation and universe, physical science. Then he goes into specific animals. That's the life science. The whole point of all of this is if Job cannot understand how God does all these things, how can he begin to understand why God lets suffering come into the world? Why God lets suffering come upon his people? If Job can answer how God made it and how God controls it, then Job could then teach us something about why God lets suffering happen. But of course, Job cannot answer any of these questions. He never does. Let's look at these questions. First of all, was the challenge to Job just a general statement in verses 1 to 3? The challenge, we looked at that last week. And then these questions about the physical world started, and you have the creation of the land questions, and then we looked at the creation of the sea. Two events that happened in Genesis chapter 1. We continue now on this list of 10 different lines of questioning here, 10 groupings. The third one now is the dawn. Can Job even explain how that works? Can he explain where it comes from? Look at verse 12. Have you ever in your life commanded the morning? Not just studied it. Not just explained, in our day, we would say, how the earth rotates and the sun's out there, and on certain times of the day we can see the sun and certain times we can't, and so on. Not just that, but did you call this into happening? Did you make this happen with your command, with your voice, Job? What a question. What a question here. Job, in all his years, has never done what God has done thousands and thousands of years. God has made the sun come up. Oh, we say, no, it's just set that way. It just works that way. We think we're wise today in that regard. But who set it up to work that way? And how did he do that? How did he create the sun and the morning dawn out of nothing? Not once in Job's life has he displayed such sovereignty like God has, such wisdom. And then he says, how about cause the dawn to know its place? Did you command the sun to rise in the morning, Job? And did you make sure that it did so exactly as it should? The idea taught here is that each day's succession of events and the sun's movement through the sky is preset by God. It has a specific pattern, and it changes over the seasons and then goes back and continues on through the cycle throughout the year. The sun knows its place is the idea. Often in these chapters, God will personify creation. And the idea is that the sun is being commanded to do something, and it does it. The morning happens just as God has laid out. And the idea here is that Job has never told the son what to do. Job has never told the son how to obey the commands and where it should go. He's never done that. Verse 13, he continues, that it might seize the ends of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it. So now God begins to talk about the difference between light and darkness. And the idea here, the metaphor is when the darkness is existing, it's like a blanket covering the earth at night. There's this dark blanket covering the earth. And when the sun comes, when the dawn comes, the blanket's edges, which are the corners of the earth, get shaken out. As the blanket is pulled up, you shake out the blankets. Why? Why do we shake out blankets? If you've ever been on a camping trip, you ever maybe stayed in an old house, you shake it out because there might be bugs, bed bugs. And the idea here is these are not just bed bugs, but the wicked. The wicked do their evil at night on this darkened earth. And it's like a dark blanket. And the wicked are out there crawling around on the blanket. And here comes the sun. And it takes the blanket and shakes all of them out. The wicked are shaken out of it. The wicked who do their evil deeds at night, they're like cockroaches that scramble when you turn on the light. Now, I've got a horror story for you. When I was first married, we probably were married a year or two, and no kids yet, so we were going to go to the lake and stay with my parents at this lake house that was only a few feet from the water. It was great. It was up on Lake Buchanan. And so we were going to sleep on the pullout couch. We did, but at night, I just kept feeling like there were things crawling around on the blanket. You turn on the light, and all of a sudden, you see something just disappear really quick. And so we let that go on again, and then I turned on the lamps, and there was just big roaches everywhere. So we slept with the lights on all night long. Because when you turn on the lights, those things would scatter and be gone. But when you turned off the lights, they'd be on your covers. And I didn't want one to get on me. And certainly my wife didn't either. That's what happens when the light comes on. The bugs that are supposed to be out at night disappear. The sun comes up. The wicked people scatter. They go. And he continues in verse 14, it is changed like clay under the seal. Now he changes the metaphor here and he says that the earth, when it's dark, it's like clay. There's no shape to it. There's no form. You can't really distinguish any patterns. You can't distinguish things when it's completely dark. And so that's like clay. But when the sun comes up, it's like the seal that's put into the clay. As the sun rises, you can distinguish things out there. You can see features, you can see lines, you can see shapes, you can see buildings, you can see trees. When the seal is pressed into the clay, it's no longer formless, but it has a shape to it, has a pattern that you can see. Also, the sun makes them stand forth like clothing. They stand forth like clothing here. In other words, clothing, when it's just normal, has no variation in its pattern. But when it's been embroidered or when it's been decorated, things stand out. Things stand forth. And so clothing that's been embroidered, you can now see the pattern on it. It's beautiful. You can look at it. The sun comes up. You can see everything. And there's a pattern to it. Job's never done anything like that. Verse 15, from the wicked, their light is withheld. Difficult verse to interpret here because what's their light? Who's the there? This is probably the wicked here, and they have their own light. They don't like the sunlight. That's God's light that exposes their sin because they're in darkness, both spiritually and physically. And so they have their own light. They have their lanterns that they go around when they're robbing, stealing, and killing people. And here comes the sunlight. Now their lights are no good anymore. Their lights are put out in that sense, and it is withheld from them because the sunlight's exposing everything that they do. And the arm raised high is broken. The sun comes up. These thieves get arrested. These murderers get arrested in the daylight. They're taken immediately in ancient times to the court. None of this sitting in prison for a few years, then going to trial and being in prison for the rest of your life. They would take this person to court if it was a murderer, someone who had maybe stolen things from a widow, for example. Immediately in the daylight, they go to court and they are judged. And their arm they thought was so strong is broken. Either they're killed, death penalty, or they are punished in a way that people would punish in ancient times. The dawn does all of this. God doesn't just bring light to the plants and light to us, but there's also this idea that justice is happening during the daytime. And that if God didn't do that, it would always be dark. Has Job done that? Job's never done that. We've never done that, but God does that. Now, number four is the underworld. The underworld. Not the mythological underworld. Although all ancient peoples thought of a place under the ground. The question is it ruled by gods, or is that even ruled by the one true God? Job knows that God rules over all things. So in verse 16, God says, "Have you entered into the springs of the sea or walked in the recesses of the deep?" Have you gone way, way down there, Job, in the sea? Go back to Genesis 1. This idea of the deep is mentioned there, and it comes up a few times in Genesis. Genesis 1 and verse 2. It's not just the deep part of the water that's over our head if we're walking into the sea. It's further down than that. Genesis 1. "In the beginning, God created the heavens, and the earth was formless and void, and darkness was over the surface of the deep." God creates the oceans, and not just the oceans, but the deep, deep down parts of the water, where the water is stored even underneath the ocean. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the surface of the water. So there's the surface of the waters, that's what we're used to seeing. And then there's the recesses of the deep. Deep ocean depths, not just what we can see and move about in, but the very deepest parts of the earth. Genesis 7:11 speaks of this again. Where did all that water come from in the flood? Is it still around today? There's a place called the deep, the recesses, the storehouses, way down underneath even the earth's crust where there is water. And that came up during the flood. And when the flood receded, some of that must, of course, gone back down. Genesis 7:11, "In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, on the 17th day of the month, on this day, all the fountains of the great deep split open and the floodgates of the sky were opened." It didn't just rain down. A lot of this water comes from underneath the oceans. It comes up. Genesis 8:2, "Also the fountains of the deep and the floodgates of the sky were closed and the rain from the sky was restrained." So when did the water begin to stop and recede? When God made it stop. Not just from the sky, which there's a lot of weather talk in Job, but we've also got this Old Testament concept, and it is true. There are places under the ground that store water. Even today, where do we get our water in the hill country? From our aquifers. Now, these are not large caverns necessarily of water, but there is a lot of water in between the layers of rock in this area. There's a lot of water underneath the earth's crust. And I could go into all the cool things that they've found in science with that. I'm not going to. I'll just tell you that they have found a type of crystal that stores water molecules and has trapped water molecules. And they think there's a whole layer of this outside of the core of the earth, just outside of the core of the earth when you get into these different layers. Regardless if that's the deep or not, there is a deep place where water is kept by God. And Job's never been there. Job couldn't go there. No one can go there. Job certainly hasn't walked in these places either. Yahweh now brings up another deep place in verse 17, this underworld place, the gates of death. "Have the gates of death been revealed to you? Have you seen the gates of the shadow of death?" Now this shadow of death, you're familiar with it from Psalm 23, but it comes up a lot in Job. Sometimes translated in your Bible, certain translations, deep darkness. And it can describe that. But the point is, if it's a shadow of death or deep darkness, it comes up 9 times in Job. They thought a lot about this. They thought a lot about fear. They thought a lot about fear associated with death. Not everyone understood, of course, where people went when they died. Job understands that. He talks about a redeemer. He talks about standing on the earth someday with his redeemer. But God says there is a deep place, and this is often called Sheol in the Old Testament, the place of the grave. There's a place where people go when they die. Not a lot of distinction here. Sometimes Sheol in the Old Testament is closer to what we think of as hell. Not so much in Job, it's just a place of death. Have you ever been to the place of death, Job? Have you ever been there? Have you ever seen where people go from life to death? We've seen people die in this world. We've seen their bodies go limp sometimes. Often in ancient times, everyone saw that. But many of us have seen that as well. And here, God is saying, not only that, but have you seen the other side of it? Have you seen the gates of death? Job's never entered into that place. He can't see it. And also verse 18, have you carefully considered the expanse of the earth? Tell me if you know all this. Now, some folks say this is just a broad, flat place on the earth, but that doesn't make sense in context here. The idea is there's an expanse, and we know this from Genesis. God calls this an expanse between the earth and the heavens. There's a gap, there's a space, and the heavens have to stay up there because God has set them there. It's like a huge column of air is holding up the clouds, is holding up all the things out there. That's how it's described metaphorically in Scripture. And now there's this idea that there's a gap between the earth's crust and what's under the earth's crust. So there's an expanse of the earth, an expanse between what we see and also what's down there. This doesn't mean there's vast caverns and lakes and countries and whatever Jules Verne wrote about. That's not what it's describing here. But the idea is there are spaces under the crust of the earth that Job's never been to. I've been to Mammoth Cave, just the entrance, the free part you can go down in. The place is huge. It feels like you're in another place. It's so huge. The ceiling on that cave is so high. And can you imagine some of the places that have never been explored? How much space there is under the earth. Carlsbad Caverns is another example that we've been to, or people have been to, but the deep caverns, the deepest trenches in the earth, Job has never gone down there. Job has never seen that. Job has no idea about what that even is. We don't even know. And God says, Job, you've never seen the underworld. You've never commanded the dawn. You've never seen the underworld. You have no clue how to run the universe. Number five, the light. God has some questions for Job about the light. Not just the sun here, but the whole concept of light. The light was created in Genesis before the sun and the moon. Where does that come from? Verse 19. Where is the way to where the light dwells? Where's the light live? Where does the light have its home before it gets to us? And darkness, where is its place? Where does light dwell? Where does darkness dwell? Where does it come from? Job, do you have answers for that? Can you help us with this, Job? Metaphorical descriptions here of light and darkness that are coming from a place. Those things have a home and they come to us. And how is it that they come to us? And where do they come from, Job? Verse 20. Tell me, Job, tell me, God is saying, that you may take it to its territory, that you may discern the paths to its home. Okay, Job, you can't tell us where it comes from, but maybe you can follow the light back, figure out where it comes from. Can we do that? Can we even look at one star with some light shining billions of miles out there and trace it to its home? Oh, someday we'll be able to. Do you really think we'll be able to go billions and trillions of miles in space before the new heavens and new earth? It really, people think a lot about mankind, the amazing things that we have been able to do, but will we be able to do these things? Job couldn't do it. Teach us, Job. Teach us the path. And darkness, who can even explain that? The best we can do is to say it's an absence of light. Darkness is an absence of light. How does that even work? How was that created? Verse 21, God says, see, this is that Socratic sarcasm. Job, for you were born then, and the number of your days is great. We joke like this sometimes, right? I'll say, you guys were around when the city of Bernie was founded. And I'll say, some of you were around when the country was founded 250 years ago. God is saying, were you there way back in the beginning when light was created? Were you there when particles of light were created? Job, you weren't there. Certainly, you can tell us all about it, though, since you know everything there is to know, Job, and can put together in your mind why there's suffering, why there's evil in this world, your number of days is so great. You've been alive so long. Job can't tell him. Dwayne Garrett says here, he, Job, has no idea how light and darkness work or where they come from. The implication, therefore, is that he should not presume to tell God how to run the world or its metaphorical light and darkness, which is what Garrett thinks here is good and evil. Only God is great. Only God is majestic. We can study these things today, but we still can't answer how they were made, how they work. We don't have all these answers. God does. God was there, though, when it was all created. Next, the snow and hail. Number 6, snow and hail. This still surprises. I remember going to California for seminary. I was going through Arizona, and it is hot in New Mexico. It's hot in Arizona. When we go over the mountains and come down in the Mojave Desert, it's 115 degrees. And we saw hail all over the ground in Flagstaff. And it looked like snow on the ground. And we thought, this is neat. Snow in Flagstaff. It turned out just to be a lot of hail. It just came out of the sky. Even though it was very hot that day, suddenly hail fell from the sky. Verse 22, have you entered the storehouses of the snow, or have you seen the storehouses of the hail? Where does ice and snow come from? Where does it come from? It comes ultimately from God. And the idea, the picture here, is that God has these great storehouses. Okay, he's giving us this description so we can understand it. Ancient people can understand it. We can understand it. There's these great storage places where God dumps these things out. Oh, we're so much smarter than ancient people, though. We know the weather patterns and how it works in the clouds and the temperature it has to be to produce hail and all that. God's not giving us that kind of science lesson. He's just stepping back and saying, I create all these things. Can you make them come about? Can you go up and speak to God about how he does these things? Have you entered a cloud and watched these things take shape? We've sent a lot of things up. I don't think any of them have captured exactly how these things take shape. These storehouses of snow, storehouses of hail, not just for the weather, though. Look at verse 23, which I have reserved for the time of distress, for the day of war and battle. This is God's arsenal, his armory. He has weapons, and some of his very powerful weapons are these things called snow and hail. Psalm 68:14 speaks of this. When the Almighty dispersed the kings there, talking about a certain battle, it was snowing in Zalmon. In other words, he can bring snow and hail into battles to help one side or the other. We see this in Joshua chapter 10, verse 11. Now it happened as they fled from before Israel, while they were at the descent of Beth Horon, that Yahweh threw down large stones from heaven. This is not talking about rocks, but hailstones. Large stones from heaven on them as far as Azekah, and they died. There were more who died from the hailstones than those whom the sons of Israel killed with a sword. God not just gave them some help, he did the fighting for them. They're just chasing people with swords, trying to get a few swings in, and the hailstones are killing everyone when they fight these Canaanites. Don't forget Revelation 16:21. These are 100-pound hailstones. John gives us the weight of these hailstones in Revelation, 100 pounds. They will fall on humanity as the plague of the seventh angel will pour out God's wrath. This is God's arsenal of weapons that come down from the sky onto the world. He says, where is the way that the light is divided or the east wind scattered on the earth? Now, this is again speaking of storms. The idea here is the light being divided is the lightning, and the east wind would often bring these storms into the Middle East. So from the east, you get these storms that would often bring hail, or sometimes mixed with a cold front coming down, would bring snow. Even into the Middle East, they still get snow today occasionally. So that's snow and hail. Job, can you tell us how these things work, how they were created, and how God uses them in battles? Also, the seventh category here, rain in the desert. Rain in the desert. This one's very interesting. Verse 25, who has cleft a conduit for the flood or a way for the thunderbolt. So in the desert, when it rains, you have these wadis. They're never running with water except when it rains. It's not like the rivers, even though around here they sometimes dry up. Usually there's some water in the rivers. These are like creeks that hardly run except when it rains. And when it does in the Middle East, it really floods. Kind of in the desert areas of the U.S. They've got these huge gullies and washes and stuff in certain cities like LA. And man, when those things run, it's like a raging river. But most of the time, it's dry. Who's created those? God has created these natural conduits for the flood. And who has made the way for the thunderbolt? So we're back to lightning and storms here. But he continues on. What is happening with these things? To bring rain on a land without people, on a desert without a man in it. No one lives there. See, God brings rain on the just and the unjust. He brings rain to grow the crops, to grow our food. He brings rain to put water in places so we can drink. We think of it that way. But think about this. God brings rain on areas that nobody lives and nobody will live there. There's no animals. There's no one who wants to live there because it's in the desert. Deserted places, wilderness. And here comes the rain. Job, have you ever done that? Job's probably never even been to these places. What does it do? It satisfies the waste and desolate land and to make the growth of grass to sprout. Why does this even happen? No one's going to benefit from it as far as humanity goes. No one's going to see these places often. And there's God putting rain there. Why does he do it? Job, can you do such things where the grass grows and the flowers bloom and both are gone? They're gone before anyone sees it. The rain comes, these things sprout up, then here comes the heat again. Everything dies. John Piper, I heard him once say that a billion flowers bloom and no one will ever see them. Why? Because God makes this world beautiful for his own sake. God's the only one who will ever see the grass grow there and the flowers bloom. And yet, it's beautiful, not just for us. We're not even there, though, in this case. It's for God. Not so he can say, oh, it's the first time I've seen a flower bloom. No, he created it. It's just to beautify his creation. There's galaxies and stars out there we've never seen. Why did God create them? We probably will never see them. He did it to beautify his creation for his glory. Job, can you do that? You can't even understand why God does that, Job. Why does God put rain where nobody lives? And yet, Job would like to tell God how to improve the running of his creation with regards to suffering. Number 8, the 8th category. Now, back to the rain. This was important to ancient peoples, right? It's pretty important to us. When it doesn't rain around here, why we complain that we can't burn brush in our yard or maybe no one's complaining they don't have to mow their yard very often, but we complain it's getting really dry, water restrictions, all these things are happening. Can't water our yard. In my neighborhood, they said you can't even power wash in June. And then they got upset. But then they changed it. Sorry, then they changed it because it rained so much. But they still say you have to water on certain days, even though we've had tons of rain. They were concerned about rain back then as well. And it comes up a lot and storms come up a lot. And God says, the rain that everybody loves to see come and water the crops, Job, does it have a father? Who begot the rain? Now, obviously, God doesn't think the rain has a father. But think about this. Every ancient group of people, they put together the rain and the storms with one of their most powerful gods. No matter what kind of gods they conceived of, which are demonic, of course, if it's not the one true God, but you have Zeus and his lightning bolts. You have the Canaanites with Baal, the god of the storm, the god of the thunderstorm. Because they understood these things are magnificent. These things are majestic. And a god must be doing this. And here's God saying to Job and to us, he's the one who does it. Not Job, not man. Who makes rain come upon the earth? It's God. Or who has begotten the drops of dew? You've got rain falling down from the sky. That's water from the sky. But every once in a while, even here, we go outside, and it didn't rain, but the grass is all wet. When my kids are little, they say, Daddy, did it rain outside? I went outside, my shoes are all soaking wet now. There's no sprinklers in the front yard. Why is that happening? It's dew. How does that work? Job, did you do that? Can you explain how all that happens, Job? Verse 29, from whose womb? Now he changes it. but it's still the idea of the birth description. How often is that used in Scripture? Even in the book of Job, we see this idea of the birth happening, the birth of the sea earlier in chapter 38. From whose womb has come the ice? Job, you don't know where ice comes from. Can you just tell me how it comes into being? Does it come out of a birth canal somewhere? The ice queen gives birth to this ice? How does that work? Can you tell us, please, Job? And how about when you walk outside and it hasn't come from the sky, but there's ice on the ground? The frost, we call it. Where does that frost come from? Suddenly, the ground is frozen, or the grass has a little bit of ice on it. Did you do that, Job? Verse 30, water becomes hard like stone. This is the freezing process. The surface of the deep is interlocked. So you've even got deep waters, lakes, rivers, they freeze over. Not the deep, not the recesses of the deep he's already talked about in the oceans, but he's talking about just these bodies of water that you wouldn't think would freeze, and they do freeze. I don't like the ice. That's why I moved to the hill country. From Dallas-Fort Worth, a little bit of ice comes upon where we live. It comes out upon the roads, and the whole thing shuts down. Trash trucks wreck. They block off whole interstates. We were tired of that. And that's just Dallas-Fort Worth. And we said, let's come down to where it doesn't ice as much. And occasionally, though, like it did this last February, we get that black ice, and we have to cancel church service because nobody can get here. That's amazing, though. It's amazing in a place like this where the temperatures are usually not that low and we don't get ice. Suddenly, we get so much ice that it shuts down the whole San Antonio area. That's God doing that. Job can't explain it. We can't explain it. We certainly can't do it. Verse number 9, ninth category, verses 31 to 33, the procession of constellations. Oh, this is amazing. We're going from under the earth to the waters of the earth, to things in the sky like rain and ice, and now we're going into outer space, the procession of constellations. Just think about the fact that God would make the stars and the constellations. He didn't have to do that, but he does. He does it for a purpose, and ultimately that purpose is for his glory. Verse 31, can you bind the chains of the Pleiades or loose the cords of Orion? Now, these are put in constellation names that we know. These are Greek originating names for our English speakers today. But the Hebrew words, as far as they've studied, match these same constellations. And there are three times in the Bible that constellations are mentioned. Only three times. In all three places, these two are mentioned, the Pleiades and Orion. Amos 5:8 mentions these two. And they are speaking there, Amos is speaking of God, he who made the Pleiades and Orion. So people think these are really important constellations. There's a lot of constellations. Ancient peoples named them all, or just about all of them. These come up in the Bible three times, the Pleiades and Orion. And then also the Bear is mentioned. Two constellations here plus the Bear, which we'll look at further down in this passage. Job in Job 9:9 also says this about God. God is the one who makes the Bear, Orion, and the Pleiades. And then he mentions a bunch of constellations in the south called the Chambers of the South. These are very important. These are ones that people look at, and they look at a lot of times in the year, and they look at them for a reason, because it marks the change of seasons for them, and it often will as well for us, even though we don't look at them. The Pleiades, also called the Seven Sisters, is seen in the east or west, depending on the time of year. And it's an open cluster of seven bright stars that can be seen without a telescope. So you can look at this with a naked eye, or you can use binoculars. And it's just a tight cluster of stars. And for some reason, even though there's huge constellations that go across the sky, the ancients were fascinated with the Pleiades. It's one of the most popular constellations, and it's often portrayed on seals in Palestine in ancient times and in Syria. In fact, today, the Japanese started a car company. They called it Subaru, and they put the seven sister stars on there as their logo. The Subaru car maker used that seven stars, and the Subaru is related to the name seven stars, the Pleiades, as their logo. All cultures attach extreme significance to the Pleiades because it marks the beginning and end of a season. The agricultural season in the Middle East, and for the Greeks, the shipping season. It was time to send out ships when the Pleiades was seen rising. The other one here is Ryan. By the way, we can't really see either one of these right now. They're up right now, but you can't see them because of the sunlight. But in the fall, throughout the spring, you can really see these. Orion, a huge constellation seen towards the south most of the year. The word in Hebrew for this means full. It's actually the word for full throughout the Proverbs and so on. And the idea is this was a foolish hunter. Even the Greeks held this, that it represented a foolish hunter who went out and he did foolish things as he was hunting. And so Orion is what the Greeks call it. That's what we call it. Again, not up in the sky right now, but very prominent in the south sky in the late fall and through the spring. When I met this young woman in astronomy class, you'll see where I'm going with this in a minute. Don't look at me funny now, elders. When I met this young woman in astronomy class in college, she was a very good-looking young woman. And we were studying the stars, but they didn't teach the constellations in astronomy class. They taught astrophysics, and I really didn't like that. So what we ended up doing is we looked up one night into the south, and I showed her what Orion looked like, because I'd seen that camping as a kid. And that was the first time that she had seen the constellation Orion. We've seen it over the years. We show our kids that now. That was my wife, Autumn. We were not married at the time, but we met in astronomy class looking at the stars, and Orion was the first constellation that we looked at together. It's a magnificent constellation. It's huge. You've got the belt of Orion, the sword. You've got him shooting a bow. It's kind of, he's laying down a lot of the times, and then he'll stand up at other times of the year. God is saying, did you set those stars there, those constellations? Did you make these stars of the Pleiades that seem to be bound up with chains, did you keep them together like that, Job? Did any of you loose the cords of Orion so he could spread out big across the sky? Can you do that? We can't do that. Verse 32, can you lead forth a constellation in its season and guide the bear with her satellites? Another constellation here, the bear, Ursa Major, huge constellation, can't see it this time of year very well. It will come up in the northwest, and it's really low though, so it's hard to see, especially if you're looking at city lights right there. But it's huge. The Great Dipper, the Big Dipper, is the tail of the bear. Did you do that, Job? Did you make that wonderful thing? By the way, we need to look up more at night and just say, wow, God, you did this. We're too much inside on our phones, inside with the lights, right next to the city lights. We need to get out and just look up at the sky and say, wow. Or even get away on vacation or something into the mountains and look up and see how many stars there are that you've never even seen. God did that. And you just keep looking. You're like, wow, this is amazing. Can you lead forth a constellation in a season like the bear or any constellation? Job, can you make it come across the sky just like it's supposed to? And every year it goes the same pattern, the same way. Can you do that? No one can do that but God. Do you know the statutes of the heavens? All these planets, stars, constellations, everything moves according to God's command and how he set it up. That's the statutes. They proceed across the sky. Job, can you do that? Job, why are you wondering how God runs the universe when he can make those things happen? We have no concept of how that happens. Those are stars millions of miles away. They're lined up so we can see patterns. By the way, it says that in Genesis 1, God made the stars so that we could map the times and the seasons. Not to worship them, not to do astrology, which is definitely pagan, but to mark the seasons like they did. It's time for harvest because we're seeing this constellation rise. And also, of course, to glorify him. That's what's amazing in Genesis 1. All these things God made, and he made the stars also. Just a short little thing. He made the stars also. Billions, trillions of stars. And it just says, it was nothing for God. He just made all those stars. 10th category, last one here. The control of thunderstorms. We're back to thunderstorms. We've had a few of these in recent months. Told you a story of last week of how my house once was struck by lightning. These things are awesome. They're powerful. They're deadly. Not too many people who get struck by lightning survive. They burn down homes. They burn down and kill crops and animals. Powerful things. Verse 34, God has some questions for Job about these thunderstorms, especially the control of them. He's already talked about the rain and the lightning. Can you raise your voice up to the clouds so that an abundance of water will cover you? Can you just tell the clouds, come on down, rain, dump it out? Can you call down the abundance of water? You'd like to cool off. It's really hot outside. Can you just say, rain, come down? God can do that. God does that all the time. God controls all those things. Job can't do that because only God brings down the rain. Verse 35, can you send forth lightnings that they may go and say to you, here we are. So Elihu brought up some of these questions about the lightning, related them to God. But God does it better than Elihu. Can you send them forth and then command them? And so they march up to you and say, here we are, reporting for duty. Can you do that with the lightning? We can barely play with little electrical gadgets, and often we get shocked with those. Here's God sending out lightning, and it reports to him and does what he tells it. Yahweh does this all the time, every day. I can't remember the number I gave you a few weeks ago, but there's just millions of lightning strikes every month happening around the earth. Verse 36, who has given wisdom in the innermost being, or given understanding to the mind? This is interesting because it's suddenly thrown in the middle of this thunderstorm line of questioning. But we're not to understand this so much as, can you give people understanding, but we're to personify this. Who can ever give these storms the wisdom that they need to go where they need to go? If you remember, wisdom is putting things into practice, knowledge into practice. Here, the storms know what to do because God's commanding them to do this, and they know where to go and how to go about storming because God has put it inside the hidden place, literally the hidden place here, the place we can't go. We can't go inside the storm and read the storm's mind, figuratively speaking. God has told it what to do. God has given understanding to the mind of the storm. In other words, storms aren't chaotic. They're not just moving all chaos. God is in control of that. He's sovereign over that. They do exactly what he tells them to do. If a hurricane hits Texas, we cannot say God had nothing to do with that. We may not like the damage, and we shouldn't. We shouldn't like the loss of life and property, but we cannot say God had nothing to do with it. God's not in control. He took a nap and suddenly a hurricane hit Texas. We read about some of these hurricanes that have hit the United States, like the one in Galveston in 1900. Devastating. Thousands of lives lost. We don't understand why God did it, but obviously, if God can control a thunderstorm, he also controls the hurricanes. He controls all things. All things. Job, can you give these storms the wisdom they need to function and go about very accurately, very precisely as they're guided? No, only Yahweh can do that. Verse 37, who can count the clouds by wisdom or tip the water jars of the heavens? I can tell you, we're never going to be able to count the clouds in the sky. I don't care how many AI systems are developed, they will never be able to do it. I even ask AI, are you ready? I ask AI, can we count the clouds? It's impossible to count the clouds, it said. The exact number of clouds in the sky per day, because clouds constantly merge, divide, and change shape. It's just, of course, reporting from all the NASA and different sites that talk about this and garbling a response together. But the point is, there's no possible way because it's always changing. If you went out there and tried to count, by the time you were done counting, they would have changed. Divided, combined together. Job, can you count the clouds by wisdom? That would take some wisdom because it's impossible for us to do. God can do it because he made the clouds. He knows exactly how many are right now upon the earth. He knows how many there will be tomorrow, how many there were 1,000 years ago, how many there will be the day Christ returns. No one can tip over these jars of water, metaphorically speaking, that are sitting in heaven that pour down rain. You can't make it rain. Yeah, I know. They threw some silver or something up in the air once and got a little cloud on the horizon. The government did that. That's nothing. Here, God is making real rain come down. We can't do that. 38, when the dust hardens into a mass. What kind of rain is this? It comes down so much that the dust is hardened from the drought, and then here comes the rain, and suddenly all that dust is sticking together because it has been soaked by the rain. When the rain comes down, the drought's over. The dust isn't hardened anymore. The clods are sticking together because there's been so much rain. Can you do that? I can't do any of these things. Job was the wisest man in the East, it says, in his day. He couldn't do any of these things. He couldn't answer any of these questions. What do we make of all these questions that God gives Job? What's the point that the Lord is trying to make here? Because he is trying to make a point, but it's a book of wisdom that demands us to have wisdom as we read it. So we have to ask ourselves, what point is he getting at? We know that he's sovereign over all these things. That's a major point throughout the whole book of Job. Nobody disagrees that God is sovereign in the book of Job. Nobody. Not today. You've got Christians who, they don't even like the fact that God is sovereign. And they'll say he's not sovereign over certain things, but he is over other things. No one in the ancient world doubted that God was sovereign, or if they believed in a different God, a false God, they didn't doubt that God controlled something. But God, the only true God, controls everything. So he is sovereign over all these things, and Job is not. So that's all we knew right there. We can just stop right there. We have an answer. God controls all things, knows all things, and we don't. So even if we don't get the answer we want from God, we have to trust him and go on with our life serving him. There's more to it here, though. If God controls all these unexplainable things in the earth, the sky, under the earth, out in space, all the chaotic storms, all these raindrops that fall upon us, ice, snow, doesn't God control all the things that come into existence? The most amazing things out there he controls. Doesn't that lead us to conclude he controls all things? You mean even that thing that happened in my life that it's just terrible? It's horrible? Does he control that? The pain, the sadness? Does he control people persecuting us as Christians? Does he control loss of life that we often experience as we go through life? Our loved ones dying? Does he control illnesses? Does he control cancer? Does he control heart disease? Oh, but Pastor, we have a part in that. We eat unhealthy, smoke, drink, do all these things to our body. Yeah, God has set it up that way. Doesn't he control that, though? Isn't he sovereign over all of it? In other words, the things that happen, they're not happening outside of God's sovereignty because he's sovereign over all of it. The furthest stars and the deepest places on the earth. There is no place where God is not sovereign. No place at all. Evil is not outside of God's sovereignty. God is not evil. God does not create evil. But God is sovereign over it. That's the only way that verses like Genesis 50:20, you remember that when Joseph says that you meant this for evil, but God meant it for good. People sin and are evil, but God means it for good. Not that God corrected it later. Not at all. God brought this about for good. Man's intent was evil. God's intent was good. That's all throughout Scripture. Suffering is not outside of his plan. Evil is not outside of his plan and providence. He's in control of all these things. That's the only way Romans 8:28 works, by the way, is if God is sovereign over all things. All things for good. Everything? Everything? I thought God and Satan were battling it out and they were kind of equal forces. That's just our culture. That's the movies. You go to the beginning of Job and what happens? Satan reports. He has a report, what he's been doing. He has to answer to God for what he's been doing. He's been out there tempting people. And God says, have you considered my servant Job? He is righteous. He is holy. There's no one like him upon the earth. Satan says, that's because you protect him. Satan says, let me do what I want to Job. And then he'll turn and he'll spit in your face, God. Of course, God allows Satan to do that. Satan's on a leash. Satan comes and tempts. He takes from Job. He brings trials upon Job. Job never, as far as we know in this book, he never learns that. What happened in heaven and that heavenly court scene, he doesn't hear about that. But God says, you don't have to understand it. You're not going to understand it. We're to trust in him. The thing molded does not speak back to its maker. The potter shapes the clay. We don't tell the potter how to shape the clay. We submit ourselves to the Lord. Jesus has come. He has given us way more revelation than Job ever had. But we still have the same message. Trust. Trust in him. Trust in him for everything. For salvation. We can trust in God for salvation, but we can't trust in him for our everyday life. Of course we can, and we should, and we must. All of it's his. Not just our eternity, but our right now, and tomorrow, and the next day, and our children, and our grandchildren, and our church, and our finances, and our work, and all the things that we do. They're his. He's given them to us. We trust him, even when times get hard, even when suffering comes, even when evil happens to us. Lord, we thank you that you've shown us this truth over and over in Scripture. Such awesome sovereignty that you bring out here in the book of Job. You show us that. It's always there, Lord. You're always sovereign over these things. But as we learn about it, we can only worship you all the more zealously, more passionately. We give of ourselves to you. Let us do that. Give of our every moment, every day is yours, Lord. And let us never use your sovereignty as an excuse for sin, but to strive for godliness, to turn away from evil, to fear you in a zealous, passionate way. And help us, Lord, to learn from this book to have godly wisdom and to always know that we are to trust in you, and you have us. You have us in your hands for love, for grace, for mercy. We thank you for that. In the name of our Lord Jesus, amen.